Hello, I'm Michelle Grattan, and this is the Conversations Politics Podcast. In the United States, a presidential election campaign, unlike any other, is drawing to an end. Many Americans have already cast their vote, but no one can say at this point with any certainty who'll come out on top this time next week. Today, we're joined by Kim Beazley, who earlier this year hung up his boots as Australia's ambassador in Washington. Kim Beazley, to start off, could you give us a snapshot of where you see the election contest at this stage?
Well, I see the election contest at the moment has the momentum with Trump and momentum on all fronts. Part of it is a product of the effort of the Republican Party. Trump has no ground game, or what the Americans call a ground game, which is a sort of granular, localised spate of workers go out, knock on doors, pull people down to the polls. But the Republican Party has, and the Republican Party needs the Congress, the House and the Senate. And that ground game's kicked in for the various Republican reps, and it's sort of an upwards coattails type effect with Trump. That's the first thing. The second thing is that a Democrat constituency is clearly not turning out as heavily as it has in the past, and that is the African American vote is not coming in at the levels that it was when Obama won. The third, of course, is the mire of Hillary Clinton's emails, latest manifestation, that is of the FBI announcement. And that seems to now start to be being followed up by leaks of some sort. There was a weird one yesterday about Bill Clinton's pardon of a fellow named Mark Rich. And one would have to say that if there is more of this over the weekend, the Trump momentum may well be unstoppable. And finally, Trump seems to have got the point that he actually has to campaign like a president and not be distracted by weirdness. And the last few days, he's stuck to message. So that's the momentum. That's driving Trump's momentum. People always think about politics as though it goes all one way or another. It's all about actually, in any country, shaving the margins. Most Democrats aren't influenced by materials or the thought of materials being leaked or the thought that there may be more to the email problem than there has been before. But if 2% are turned off and 2% decide not to vote, then Hillary loses. So, you know, the opinion of most Democrats is less important than the opinions of those at the margin. So at the moment, one would say that even though Trump's road to the White House, given the past voting habits of the various states essential to it, is unlikely to come to fruition, he's got a better chance than most people gave.
Now, you've spent a lot of time in the United States and operated as an ambassador at a high level talking to officials. Are you surprised at the way this whole campaign has played out?
Not particularly. I've always, in my comments, been a little bit, not partial to, but cognizant of the possibility of a Trump win. I've not thought it likely. I thought it more likely that Hillary would win, but I wouldn't have taken it off the table. And I still at the moment would say that if there's not more revelations over the weekend and there is a kick-in of the enormous amount of money that Hillary has and the advertising is supported by it is good, I'd still say slightly on balance, she's more likely to win. But the anger, the energy in this campaign is within one group, and that is the sort of the white working class, mainly male but also female, who feel that America has been taken away from them. Nobody else, with the exception of the Hispanics, And that is generated not so much by Hispanic dislike of the Republican Party, but dislike of Donald Trump. There is, aside from that, no real energy in this campaign. So if you've got the biggest engine of energy going, it gives you a sort of irreducible minimum. And if that irreducible minimum becomes important in states like Wisconsin, Ohio, Iowa, as it is, then Trump obviously has the capacity to take states out of the Democratic column. So I have not been particularly surprised by this election. One has been aware that that group, and more broadly the white community, has been unhappy for quite a while.
And why are they so angry?
Well, working class is angry because it's got no money. I mean, they call themselves middle class. We call that group in society about which I'm talking about working class. But the point is that they have not had a real wage rise for more than 30 years. Our equivalent group has seen their incomes increase 2.5-fold. They see themselves as having donated jobs overseas. Foreign trade may well have generated 6 million jobs for the United States, but it's deprived them of 1 million. And then you've got, they don't actually have any bargaining arrangements anymore for wage increases, because in most places the unions have gone. Right to work laws has clubbed them out. And then what they look at their own pay packet, they see that their tax goes out. They look at the very wealthy and they see that it doesn't. And yet when it comes to, say, bailing out folks from a financial crisis, the bailout's at the top and the trickle-down's non-existent. This is the oddity of the Trump campaign. At one level, it's a very left-wing campaign, certainly drawing on heavily left-wing sentiment. I have said in the odd speech I've given around the country that Trump is in the odd position that apart from on race, which is a very big apart from, but apart from on race, Trump is not only to the left of Hillary Clinton, he's to the left of Bernie Sanders.
So to what extent would you see a parallel between Trumpism and Hansenism?
Well, Hansenism has not got the base that Trumpism has. I mean, we're talking about Trump getting 50%, and the last election we saw Hansen get 4. There's a very big difference.
But there is this parallel of anger, economic anger, isn't there?
Yes, but in Australia that is mitigated. The words are the same. The music is the same, but the decibels are different. And when we went through the reforms that globalised our economy in the 1980s, an immense array of support systems were put in place, including a very large middle-class income tax cut, including free healthcare or near free healthcare, including immense support for education and training arrangements, including immense support for families, both educationally and directly. None of that is put in place in the United States. None of that operates at the national level. So you'll find pockets around Australia where people feel a sense of grievance. But unlike the Americans, it's not a real grievance. And that will always put a bit of a check on where Hanson is going. Mind you, if major political parties legitimise Hanson by playing footsie with her, then something altogether different might emerge.
Now, one big difference, of course, between the American and the Australian system is non-compulsory voting there.
Yeah.
In terms of people turning out, do you think that Americans in this election will make a decision late in the piece as to whether to vote, or would they have already decided, no, I'm opting out?
It's got to be said that to this point of time, early voting exceeds the early voting of the last Obama election. And already I think about 26 million have voted. And the trend lines there are mixed. The starting trend was good for Hillary. The recent trend in one or two key states, particularly Florida, has not been. The participation of African Americans usually high, in early voting has not been high in African Americans in a number of areas in the United States turning out on the day feel intimidated. So they're in their minds encouraged effectively not to bother to participate. So the worry for the Democrats is they're not out there yet in an environment which is more conducive for them in voting. I would say that I would be surprised, having said all that, I would be surprised if as many people turned out for this election as turned out for the last in 2012 between Obama and Romney. On the other hand, the crowds that Trump has been getting have been persistently huge. And, you know, one has to assume that that may represent something. And if it does, it may be a big turnout.
You mentioned people being intimidated. Is there much intimidation in an American election? What form does that take?
People wandering up and down the lines and asking for your ID. I mean, it's a classic form. Most of them do have to take a photographic ID to the polls. But many of them turn up, and I don't think they're necessarily allowed to be deprived of a vote in all states if they don't have an ID with them. But if you're in a state, for argument's sake, that doesn't have that ID requirement, but somebody nevertheless turns up at the polls and starts, you know, looking very official and starts running around demanding your ID. The African-American experience of officialdom is not good. And this chap may simply be a Republican poll worker, but he gets freighted with all sorts of things in the African-American mind.
I think it's still hard for many people to understand how Donald Trump got through the whole Republican process, given there are so many candidates in the beginning and nobody expected that. Do you think the Republican Party could or should have done more to head off his run?
The Republican Party rules are at fault here. If the Republican Party had the Democratic Party's rules, Trump would not have been the candidate. In the Democratic Party, their rules are, firstly, a phalanx of superdelegates with about 20% of the vote, and they're all the party good and great. The other 80% are elected by state primary, either primaries or caucuses, but they're elected on the basis of proportional representation, not winner-take-all. And that's so across the country. See, the point about Trump is he had 16 opponents, but he always had that solid support that I referred to earlier, which constitutes about 35% of the Republican base. So the man with 35% in a 16-17 player field is king. And that kept Trump going through the first 20, I think, states where the Republican Party does have PR. So that by the time that process completed, there are only about one or two standing, and Trump was well ahead. So then he had to fight basically Ted Cruz and John Kasich, neither of whom have broad appeal in the Republican Party, though Kasich would have been an excellent candidate. What the Republicans are learning to their chagrin is that basically anybody could have beaten Hillary Clinton except Trump. And if Trump does win, they're going to have on their hands a rogue president.
Well, if he doesn't, there'll be some bitter post-mortems, won't there, in that context. You were ambassador, of course, during the last presidential election. What does the Australian ambassador do before this contest to reach out to both sides?
Massive amounts. I mean, basically, you do go to all the things like the conventions, and that gives you a good chance of meeting, if you've got one or two good contacts, a whole range of useful people. But more important, what you do is you compile lists of people who are likely to find their way through to the selection processes for semi-ministerial office or political office. and to identify those who are in areas that are significant to Australia, which is usually the foreign affairs and national security area, and get close to them. Now, in my case, as in the last election, there was only one side which actually threw up that challenge. On the Democrat side, all the folk who were going to emerge subsequently as the second-term Obama membership, I knew pretty well anyway. But you did meet with them. But it was we drew up a list, I think, from memory of about 300 Republicans who are likely to emerge in a Romney administration, and we just went after them, which is a terrific thing to do.
It would be a delicate operation, though, wouldn't it? Because you have to keep a certain distance and neutrality.
Not really. We're not going to intervene in the politics anyway. We're automatically neutral to that extent. Americans like robust engagement. You can't sort of wander in and pussyfoot around the place. You've got to go in and say what you want. Now, it's like when you see in congressmen, too, or a different part of the same process. You never want to go into see a congressman without something, either a major question to ask him or something to seriously put to him, because they don't like to waste their time. And Americans don't like wasting their time. So you do a bit of the hail fellow well met stuff around the social engagements in the conventions or prior to debates, intra-party debates and inter-party debates, which are great opportunities to mix with folk. But apart from that element being hail fellow well met, the rest is very pointed.
Given the excitement of this election, you must be wishing you were there a bit.
I when I was the ambassador to Washington, I just missed politics every day. In this year, I'm missing the United States every day. I mean, I was generously treated 6 years as the ambassador, but gee, I would have liked a seventh.
Can we just discuss, Kim Beazley, the implications for Australia?
Yep.
If Donald Trump did, against the odds, win, what would it mean for this country?
Very, very heavy lifting. Look, we often think of the alliance and our other friendships in the region, Chinese, others. We often think of them with what I would call on a one-dimensional chessboard. Now, somehow or other, there are diplomatic leanings that we have, and we're capable of directing them in various different directions. We just make choices about that. No, it's not like that. The American alliance has a broad head but an even deeper body. We are just deeply embedded in their intelligence and military system for a whole variety of purposes. And we are now deeply embedded in the American economy through investment. So we have a massive interest with the United States. But we also have one other attribute, which applies not to Hillary Clinton, but to Donald Trump. And that is, we have the only alliance that Donald Trump likes. Of all the arrangements the United States has around the globe, he likes the one with Australia best. Now, that imposes a huge challenge on us, because were he to implement the policies that he talks about in regard to the Asian region, we would be confronting strategic damage and possibly economic disaster. There will be an expectation on our friends, all of them, people who are American allies like the Japanese and the Koreans, people who are American competitors like the Chinese, people in Southeast Asia are all a bit aghast at the world washing around them. They would have one demand of us, and that would be, what are you going to do to use whatever influence you have to make these guys' policies potable?
And when you talk about those policies, you're talking about US withdrawal from various commitments, making allies bear more of the burden, things like that.
That'd be that. That's at the strategic level. But we'd certainly have a view about a 45% tariff on Chinese goods into the United States. And particularly if that 45% tariff became a bit, across the board in Asia. basically what you would then be talking about is Asian economic recession.
And if Hillary Clinton wins, what are the implications for Australia? How would things go?
Well, more sotto voce. Hillary has a very strongly favourable view towards Australia. Obama had one too, but I'd say Hillary's is deeper. And I think that, and she also has, Hillary's got a far more finely tuned sense of power realities than most other people who are in politics. And she understands Australia's weight, which is much higher than Australians think it is. Now, most Australians don't know that our economy is almost the size of Russia's. And she has she sees us as a skilled, well-off, and purposeful people, and she will have things for our will and purpose, and a lot of them may well involve decisions that topics that we're quite uncomfortable with.
For example?
Well, I think for starters, she'd be looking very strongly at a deeper integration of Australian and American forces in the region. She might be looking more vigorously than Obama has been at deployment of American aircraft from Australian bases. She'd in all probability look quite strongly at the possibility of rotating ships through Stirling. I mean, but integration would be an interesting thing. I mean, she thinks very seriously militarily, and she would look at a number of elements of the Australian Armed Force, not just her, but, you know, her administration. For example, the Marine Corps has got 3 flat tops operating in the Pacific area. They need 5, and they are not going to get them, not under any plan that there is for the American armament. So what is there? Well, there's the possibility you could almost effectively wet lease the 2 Australian LHDs. I mean, these are all sorts of... Now, all of these things are freighted not just simply with the strategic, they're also freighted with the political. But I would say over the next 3 or 4 years, they would come to be very much part of the Australian agenda.
And whoever wins the Trans-Pacific Partnership looks to be down the drain unless it gets through in that lame duck period of the Obama regime.
Well, it'll certainly not get through in that lame duck period if Trump is president. It's a very, very outside possibility it might get through with Hillary. But I also think that it will depend a lot about how Hillary comes in. And my fear is that basically Hillary will come if she wins, in a miasma. And that is a crippling investigations on a multiplicity of fronts, endless Republican attempts at impeachment, and a deeply wounded presidency from the outset. That's not the only road ahead, but it's a possible path ahead, in which case, it'll all be problematic, anything, the conversation with the United States. But supposing that is not the case, then I think more likely it will be a quite productive relationship. And Hillary will want to try to get a revised version of the TPP up, I think. I mean, she hasn't actually ruled it out. Trump's ruled it out. But she has talked about, getting a couple of forms in place. And if she gets a decent relationship with the Republican Party and not the one I described, she might get something through.
Much of politics is personal. Can you just gaze into the crystal ball and tell us what you think it would be like in both the Trump presidency and the Clinton presidency meeting with Malcolm Turnbull?
Well, Turnbull would be... Turnbull, from his business days, has got experience with meeting triumphalist and robust would-be partners, adversaries or whatever. I think he would find that Trump, he probably already knows Trump, but he'd find Trump is a type that he's dealt with frequently in the past in different contexts, he'd probably have a conversation with him that was quite good. Hillary is in an alignment ideologically and programmatically very close to where Turnbull would like to be. So I would think that he'd get on for different reasons pretty well with either of them.
The picture you paint for the next 4 years in the United States is a fairly dark one, lots of clouds. Is that right? Whoever wins, it's going to be pretty hard times because they come to the presidency with different sets of flaws.
Yeah, look, most of the United States is not angry, and much of the United States is not white. Most of the United States is happy. You know, there's a lot of guns out there in the United States, but I've got to say that their levels of violence in the community are much lower than ours, but that's far more lethal. You know, we've got a higher divorce rate, we've got a higher rates of home violence than the United States has, but it's never accompanied by a machine gun. There's a lot in the United States. When you're actually there in the United States, it's not a bleak place at all. It's a very polite place. It's in many parts quite prosperous. It's redolent of people having a conversation with each other. And unfortunately, all of that is very boring copy. I don't expect that to change whoever wins. But I do expect that there will be events, whoever wins, which will be the things that grab the headlines, not the the friendly disposition at the high school football game. In the case of Trump, I think all these things will flow from his vindictive character and his, his determination to jail Hillary, and the fact that he'll have some level of control over the IRS and the FBI. That will certainly be an interesting dynamic to see how that works its way through. Also, there are a lot of people in the Republican Party who would just like a chance to bring him down and put Mike Pence in as president, so he's going to have to think about that. You come over to Hillary's side, there is what I described in that sense, our Republican disposition to investigate a death. But that's now. One of the things that Hillary is very good at is reaching out. And she's a natural reacher out to Republicans. She's the last centrist Democrat. You know, most of the Democratic Party, we've been talking about the Republican Party, the Democratic Party has gone to the left of Hillary. And she is the last person, I think, in American politics really capable of consensus building. So running counter to all that propensity to investigation will be her her desire to have a presidency based on a conversation, particularly with her opponents.
This has been a very extraordinary and bitter and damaging campaign. Do you see it as a one-off, or do you think that it's part of a trend to a different sort of campaigning? And do you think, given that what starts in America often ends up in Australia, we can prevent the contagion of this sort of campaigning to our system?
Look, I think there's a very great difference between our system and the Americans, and that is Westminster is less personal than a presidential system. So our folk are nowhere near to inclined to the depth of the personal demonisation that takes place in the United States.
And won't go in that direction in the future.
And we won't, no, but all these things are relative, you know. You don't see a trend in the United States that you couldn't look around to Australia and identify a strand. But it's the collective thing. It's the volume of it. It's the degree to which it reflects a large portion of society or a small one. So we will always, I think, with the structure of our politics, be less inclined to the sort of personal that the United States exhibits. Also, we don't have that much money. I mean, the Clinton campaign will have spent by the end of it $2.5 billion, and the and probably Trump's over $1 billion, and then there's all the House races and Senate races that are coming in on top of that. I mean, what is ours? You know, the average political party would at best come out spending about 30 odd million, something like that. I mean, we spend here the totality of our election on what the Americans might spend in a tight Senate race in a single state.
It's a fairly amazing phenomenon, the power of money in the United States in politics. Kim Beazley, thank you so much for talking with us today and for those insights. And that's all from the Conversations podcast for now. Thank you to my producer, Pat Hutchins. I'm Michelle Grattan. We'll be back with another interview really soon.